Against the Wind by the Opteryx, read by Argentum Lupin. The room is dark, more so because of the thick curtains pulled over the windows than the time of day, and light barely seeps around the edges of the fabric, like a pale frame. Frank can't see the storm, but the thick waves of rain pounding against the glass are incessant, overwhelming. There's something behind him, noiseless but present, like a tug at his spine, and when he turns, there's a ghost. And in the shadow next to it, his mother. The storm must have broken through at last, because she's soaking, black dress weighed down and choking with water, and her face is slick with it. Her mouth is moving to speak, but he can't hear her over the noise of the rain, and when he looks at the ghost, it looks back at him. It's the reason they've all lost their voices, why he can't hear his mother, why when he looks at the ghost, he's looking back at himself, and his eyes are shining dots in the black. Frank wakes, startled. There's something tapping at the window, and he abruptly turns his head to look, almost instinctively preparing himself for a burst of rain across his cheek. There's no storm, however, just a tree branch swaying gently against the glass, and a bright, thick band of sunlight cuts across the covers to his chest. He exhales and lies back down, staring up at the ceiling. Over 6 months in this room, in this place, in this manor, and he forgets every single time he wakes, and everything is still warm. The hallways are packed with servants bustling around, arms full of new crisp sheets and silver trays. They nod to him, deferring, and Frank nods back, although he is certain it is still too forced. He can't seem to make it look practiced. He stays close to the walls so as not to get in the way until he arrives in the main wing of the house. The windows in the front hall are raised, propped open with wooden rods, and the servants are rolling up some of the larger carpets from the front hall for where the musicians will go. There are several long, low tables for food underneath the curve of the double staircases, polished silver vases full of flowers already in place, and outside the gardeners are already positioning the ladders to hang the lanterns before the guests arrive, at dusk. It's not quite autumn yet, but there's a crispness to the air that wasn't present only a few weeks ago. The whole house smells refreshed, turned over, and Frank pulls his coat slightly tighter around him as he ducks down the side passage and into the kitchens, which are even busier than usual. He tries to keep out of the way, ducking the elbows of the kitchen help as they breeze by, but it's inevitable that someone, "Mr. Iero," Chantal calls to him happily from her place at the marble-topped counter. "What a nice surprise! We didn't see you at breakfast this morning."
"Slept in, I'm afraid," Frank says, smoothing down the front of his waistcoat. "You know I'd never miss a meal from you otherwise."
"You can't afford to miss a meal, you're all bones anyway," Chantal says. She's kneading dough, and Frank can't help but be temporarily mesmerized by the motions of her warm, white hands. "But I've never known you to sleep in, either. Are you all right?"
"Oh, yes," Frank says, and backs up a little as Laura, one of the cooks, comes hurrying by him with a heavy sheet of unfilled custard cups. "Tired, I suppose. Hard to sleep with so much excitement in the house."
"You've never seen one of their parties, have you?" Chantal asks.
"No, I never have," Frank says, and fights the urge to fidget. He's not new at the manor, not technically, but he doesn't feel his place. Chantal doesn't call him sir like the others, though, at least when they're alone, and it's an unimaginable relief. Frank aches to offer to help, roll up his sleeves and actually do something useful, but knows full well they would never let him, or would think it strange for someone else to desire to do so.
"Well, you're in for a treat," Chantal says. "Lizzie, grab the sugar pots before you head to set the platters. We have to finish off the crusts. And you, Mr. Iero, eat something. There's some cold ham left in the box from this morning, and the scones haven't gone too cold. You look far too flushed, and the day hasn't even truly started yet."
Frank nods and ducks into the cool back room to fold a scone into a napkin. He puts a hand to his face, just to see, and it is warm, especially against the cold air of the open ice box. It's nothing, though, just excitement. And he doesn't think further of it as he hurries up the stairs to the back parlor, where his real duties await.
"But I want to go watch," Matilda pleads. "Mama said the cake for Papa is 2 stories tall, and I want to see."
"I doubt that very much," Frank says, calmly flipping to a new page in the book. "If it was 2 stories tall, they wouldn't be able to fit it through the front door, and they would have to keep it outside in the garden, where the birds would eat it first."
Matilda looks appropriately horrified, although if it's at the idea that the cake is not, in fact, 2 stories tall, or that it might be eaten by birds before she can see it,
Frank can't be quite sure.
I hear people are coming from all over, James says,
pulling Rolf more firmly into his lap until the dog gives in and settles across his legs.
Even as far as the next county.
Even farther than that, Matilda counters.
Your father is a very important man, Frank says, who would be very glad to know that his children were equally as excited about things like history as they were about cake. English history, in fact, which is an excellent coincidence, because that is what we are studying today.
Are you going to the party? Matilda asks, not even moving to pick up her book. She lies back on the chaise and crosses her arms behind her head, and Frank's so startled by the question he doesn't even reproach her for putting her feet on the cushion.
I hadn't really considered it, he says.
It's a bit of a lie. He had considered it, but not truly all that seriously. Like James said, there would be guests from even the next county. Frank doesn't have any idea of what they would even speak about. That's probably not the point.
You must,
Matilda says, with incredible seriousness, as she seems to be at the age where everything deserves such gravitas.
Papa will be so sad if you don't, and Mama says there's a wonderful surprise for him, and for us too.
Frank pauses and smooths out a crease in the page. Someone has been bending the corners down again, and he frowns at it.
If I agree, will you sit properly on the chaise and listen while I tell you about William the Conqueror?
Frank asks, and Matilda sighs.
There's a huge battle at the end, Frank says, and somebody gets an arrow through the eye.
Matilda immediately sits up.
Really?
She asks.
I guess you won't ever learn, Frank says sadly, since daydreaming about parties is apparently a far better use of your tutor's time than actually learning.
Can we act it out, like last week in Carthage?
James asks, already at attention. Frank waits, just for a moment, to make sure they're actually paying attention, but both children are watching him attentively, sitting up straight, eyes wide. Even Rolf seems interested, both ears peaked and his tail momentarily still. Frank sighs dramatically, and Matilda grins, knowing they've won.
Fine, Frank says, and closes the book. But I'll be testing you on this later. Matilda, you're William the Conqueror. James, you're Harold. But first, we set the scene.
By the time they get to the coronation, Matilda's hair is out of her ribbons and James's shirt is untucked and rumpled, but Frank is largely sure they've managed to pick up most of the important bits of the Battle of Hastings. He's feeling exhausted, though, limbs heavy, and it's too early, and the battle too short, to really warrant the reaction. He exhales heavily, and there's a coarseness in his throat that wasn't present before, like a catch on the end of each breath, and Frank stops, mid-exhale. No.
Mr. Iero,
Matilda says, stopping suddenly, concerned.
Are you all right?
I'm fine, Frank says, and smiles at her. Absolutely fine.
Frank pauses on the staircase back up to his quarters with a hand on his chest. The stairway is empty, for the moment, with most of the servants called to the other side of the manor to attend to the kitchens and the main hall. The silence and echo off the cold stone makes his breathing sound even louder, and he feels immediately nauseated at the thought that someone else might be able to tell. He undoes the top few buttons of his too tight, it feels so tight, shirt so he can put his palm on his skin. It's already clammy, the shirt starting to stick to the back of his neck, along his collarbones. Someone opens the door at the bottom of the stair and laughs loudly to their companion behind them, and Frank fumbles to pull his shirt closed as he hurries up the final two steps to his landing and through the cracked door to the hall.
Where's the pianoforte?
Frank asks, staring at the empty wall between the two windows. There are long indentions in the carpet where it used to rest, and two deep scratches in the wood of the floor, but the pianoforte itself is gone. I sold it, his mother says simply.
That's Papa's pianoforte,
Frank frowns.
You can't.
It was your father's pianoforte, and I can, his mother interrupts, not even looking up from the collar of the shirt she's restitching. Music never made your father any money when he was alive. I am certainly not going to wait around for it to start, now that he's dead. Frank fists his hands by his sides and stares back down at the floor. The space where the stool was, where his father sat for years, is worn, and the carpet rubbed thin where his heels used to rest. Come away from the window, Frank, and study your books, his mother says. You'll catch a death of cold. Frank fumbles with the buttons of his shirt sleeves and tries not to mumble a curse under his breath. The cuffs do not seem to want to cooperate and fasten properly, and once again Frank wishes he could just strip it off and stay in the cool darkness of his bedroom. He can hear the party guests outside, laughing loudly, and the band is already playing a waltz. He's delayed enough. He'll just go down, wish Sir Way many happy returns, make sure that Matilda sees he is participating in order to fulfill his end of their agreement, and then make his quiet retreat. He finally decides that he is dressed presentable enough for the arriving company, nervously smooths his hair back into place, and hopes his hands don't shake. He isn't nervous, not exactly, but he's exhausted, and he has to stop to cough a few times and clear his throat. Breathing is becoming more difficult, has only exacerbated over the course of the afternoon, and as the cool night set in over the property. He knows what will come next. They can't know. Frank is too new, too easily replaced, and he has always been incredibly self-aware about his position. He looks at himself in the mirror, wearing the clothes they provided to him, in a room of their furnishing, and his gut swims with fear. It's easy enough to slip through the east staircase and down through the back gallery to approach the main hall from the side, avoiding any potential noticeable entrances. He closes the door behind him and waits until the majority of the crowd has turned to applaud the musicians before he slips through the threshold to stand among them. Matilda and James have been quite right. Frank recognizes faces from several of the important family dinners he'd witnessed in the few months he'd been residing in Way Manor. Women swirl around him in fine clothing, shining with jewels, and the men look like they belong, back straight and proud. Frank fights the urge to nod, shrink back. They don't know him here, don't know his position. He fancies himself one of them, if only for a moment, but then the song changes and the couples fluidly move into a dancing formation, and Frank immediately feels off balance, watching the effortless way they move together. Even with his uncertain footing, he cannot help but be swept up in the moment, however. The hall is beautiful, the guests laughing and happy, and the lanterns rise and sink gently in the trees outside. It is, for the moment, lovely, and Frank sighs deeply. The sigh catches in his throat, however, and he has to cover his mouth to stifle the rough, sudden sound. The ferocity of the pain in his lungs surprises him, and he has to step back against the wall to steady himself. It's time to retire, he thinks, hands splayed across his chest, as if it could contain the rattling within. Frank makes his way through the crowd and back towards the escape of the gallery from which he entered. He'll have to apologize to his masters in the morning, when he's feeling better. If he embarrasses them now by causing a scene, he will be mortified. He's almost there, just past the room full of couples still spinning happily to the music, when a voice calls out across the hall.
Mr. Iero!
It cries, and Frank turns just in time to stop Matilda from clinging to his trouser leg.
You're here!
Of course, Frank says, covering for himself, and turns back to face her properly. We had a pact. I would never undo such a pact with Miss Matilda Way. Matilda grins, bright and happy, and Frank is glad she found him. Her hair is a mess, as usual, falling out of the plaits he knows her mother worked so hard to put in place, but she's wearing a new frock, and her cheeks are tinged pink from excitement. Are you having a good time? He asks.
Wonderful,
she says emphatically, tugging again on his trousers.
There's cake everywhere, and Mama let me have some of the punch. Only from the bowl on that table, none of the other punch she made quite clear. But, oh, it's just lovely. All of the dresses and fine ladies, and they let me sit up by the musicians and ask me what I would like to hear, and...
That does sound wonderful, Frank agrees. Where has your brother gone off to tonight?
He's out in the garden with the Supporta boys. Mother sent them all out when they tried to climb on the dessert table. I wanted to go too, but I didn't want to miss anything. There's just so much to see,
she gushes happily. Her eyes light up suddenly.
Have you talked to Mama and Papa yet?
Oh, no, I haven't, Frank replies, slightly embarrassed. I haven't actually been able to find them in the crowd. Matilda grabs his hand and tugs determinedly, and Frank dutifully allows himself to be led back towards the main hall.
They are by the dining table, she tells him, pulling him through the crowd. You must say hello to Papa. He asked me where you were, and I said I had not seen you, and he looked quite sad.
He did? Frank asks, both surprised and chastised somehow. He hadn't expected that.
Of course,
Matilda says, in the tone of voice she reserves for when he's asked her far more questions than she cares to dignify to answer. Sir Michael Way and his wife, the Lady Alicia, are standing by the bottom of the grand staircase, cheerfully talking to another couple.
Papa!
Matilda calls out happily, and when Sir Way turns to see, he smiles warmly, without any indication that it is not genuine. Sir Michael Way, in Frank's limited experience in the manor, is a man who is entirely hard to read the majority of the time, but still is not hesitant in expressing himself when he feels the desire to do so.
Ah, so you did find him at last,
Sir Way says, and nods to Frank.
I wasn't sure if we'd see you tonight.
Wouldn't miss it for the world. Happy birthday, sir, Frank says, and bows slightly, the dignity of which is slightly compromised by Matilda still clinging to his hand, bouncing up and down on her toes.
So good to see you, Frank,
Lady Way says, smiling kindly, arm wrapped through her husband's. Her dark, thick hair is pulled off of her neck, and the breeze from outside makes the feathers tucked behind her ear sway. She looks radiant, as always, and Frank tries not to feel too small in his simple, dark clothes.
Will you be here for the surprise? Matilda asks, tugging at his hand.
The surprise? Frank asks, looking from her to the Ways. Sir Way shrugs and nods towards his wife.
I can't get a word out of her about it, except that I'll be thrilled.
Lady Way smiles coyly.
You will. And soon, Maddie. Be patient. We have to wait until the musicians break, so everyone can see. It's not just a surprise for us, then?
Matilda asks.
It's a surprise for everyone,
Lady Way replies.
Now, go find your brother and make sure he isn't covered in mud before you bring him back in here to watch.
Yes, ma'am,
Matilda says, and lets go of Frank's hand to disappear back through the crowd towards the front of the hall. Frank feels oddly lost without her little hand clinging to his. He smooths his palm down the front of his waistcoat and hopes the Ways don't notice the nervous gesture.
James was telling us at dinner all about William the Conqueror,
Lady Way says, eyes light.
I have never seen that child so excited about history.
Well, Frank starts, hating himself for always feeling so flustered in their presence. James is an incredibly smart, quick boy. He learns quite fast.
You are too modest, she says. The children seem to actually enjoy their lessons, which is something I have never seen before, and we've had several tutors over the years who would rather throw up their hands than contend with the children's spirits. I don't know quite what methods you use, but we are delighted to have you continue.
Frank can't even formulate a response, and can only hope his face doesn't flush any further. He's already too warm, and a bead of sweat runs down his spine. He can feel the rattling in his lungs returning, the scratching of a cough beginning at the bottom of his throat. The idea of making a fool of himself, of the way seeing, fills him with absolute dread. The musician's song rises in crescendo, and the Ways turn for the briefest moment to watch, and Frank seizes the opportunity to let out a sincere, "Excuse me," before slipping back through the crowd towards the row of pantries off the gallery behind the grand staircase. He's racked with coughs as soon as he makes it around the corner, and he hurriedly ducks into the side room and shuts the door, leaning back against it and futilely covering his mouth to hide the noise. The coughs are painful, jagged, and he can barely catch a breath. It shouldn't be this bad so soon. It simply makes no sense.
Are you all right?
Someone asks, and Frank is so surprised he almost hits his head against the door, the motion setting off another round of coughing. It's getting harder to breathe, like something is squeezing his chest. Finally, finally, he gets his breath under control enough to look up. It takes him a few tries. His eyes are watering, he has to blink repeatedly until things swim back into focus. But there's a man standing in the dark of the pantry, palms up and outstretched towards him, eyes wide.
"Why are you in the cupboard?"
Frank asks, and immediately wishes for another coughing fit, so he can't say such embarrassing things to people he doesn't actually know. But his traitorous lungs, for the moment, work as they should.
"Why are you in the cupboard?"
the man responds, palms lowering slightly.
"I must have had some dust in my throat," Frank says, lightly. "But I'm feeling fine now, so I should just get back to the party."
The embarrassment of being seen like this burns at him, and he's already fumbling with the doorknob behind him to escape back into the main gallery.
"Wait! Don't! You can't! Don't tell anyone I'm in here,"
the man says, taking a step towards him. And Frank pauses.
"Are you supposed to be in the cupboard?"
Frank asks, his mind racing. Should he call for help? Is this man planning something? He could have just wandered in through the back hall. The servants would be too busy tonight to notice. but finally his thoughts catch up with him and he pauses, assessing. The man is dressed too finely to be a wanderer, and if he is there for nefarious purposes, he's doing an excellent job of appearing almost entirely harmless. He's dressed in all black, except for a deep gray waistcoat, and has pale, smooth skin that Frank can see clearly even in the dim light of the pantry. A gentleman, surely. It's strange. He can still hear the music from the musicians playing in the main hall, but through the door it sounds muted, otherworldly, and makes the entire situation seem even more odd.
"I am supposed to be in the cupboard," the man says. "But no one knows I am in the cupboard, so you cannot tell anyone."
"Why are you supposed to be in the cupboard?" Frank asks, curiosity piqued.
"I feel like perhaps I should be the one asking you the questions," the man says. "After all, this is my cupboard. I've grown quite comfortable here."
"I think perhaps you have spent too long in here, rather," Frank says.
"You are entirely right," the man says. "I'm going to start thinking of the sacks of flour as confidants if I have to stay in here much longer. Has the band almost finished playing?"
"Yes, I think they're nearing a break. They are going to announce Sirway's birthday surprise and—"
Frank stops, finally really looking at the man in front of him. Something about him suddenly seems so familiar, although he knows he's never seen the man in front of him before.
"You're Gerard Way," Frank says,
and immediately wishes he could cover his mouth and disappear. But now that he's made the connection, it's obvious. He's seen Gerard Way's face hundreds of times, in dozens of paintings throughout the family gallery. He looks different than in most of the paintings, however. Thinner, older, with impressively disheveled hair, and a bright, slightly lopsided smile that is absent from most of the art.
"I am indeed,"
the man says, seemingly delighted that Frank figured it out, rather than annoyed at his impropriety.
"You're the birthday surprise,"
Frank says, finally putting it together. Sir Way spoke often of his older brother, and always in fond, warm tones, but never recently in any way that hinted that he was arriving back from his life overseas.
"I am indeed," Master Way says, and bounces up and down on his toes.
It's a motion that reminds him so much of Matilda that Frank is amazed he didn't spot the resemblance immediately.
"Does he have any idea?" Master Way asks, seriously.
"No, not a one," Frank says. "How long have you been in here?"
"Forever," he sighs. "I'm starving. I may have eaten most of the tin of biscuits they'd left in here. Don't tell Alicia."
"I won't," Frank says. "Well, yes, it was very nice to meet you. I should be going."
"Are you sure?" Master Way asks. "It's a lonely cupboard. You are actually very welcome to stay."
"No, I would hate to impose," Frank manages.
He's humiliated, truly, to be in such close quarters with Sir Way's older brother and to have spoken so forwardly with him. Somewhere in his mind, his mother is fussing at him for being so rude, so unheeding of proper society rules. He'll have to apologize profusely later, when he's not on the verge of embarrassing himself with his faulty, weak lungs. Behind him, he can hear the band come to a full, beautiful crescendo, and then fall into silence.
"That's my cue," Master Way says, grinning.
He takes a step forward, and Frank fumbles at the doorknob before he can step even closer, opening the door and allowing him to pass him by and into the gallery. Master Way straightens and brushes the front of his coat.
"I have to go surprise my brother. Shall I see you at the party?" he asks,
and he seems genuinely interested.
"I hear there's food even besides biscuits from the pantry."
Oh, yes,
Frank manages, back still pressed to the open door. Master Way must not realize Frank is practically a servant, and to point it out would be almost all the more humiliating. Master Way smiles.
"Excellent. A pleasure,"
he says, nodding a little, and then walks quietly and confidently towards the light that spills from the open doors of the main hall. Frank stays where he is, still holding on to the door. There's silence, and someone speaking, and then a joyful, happy swelling of voices that Frank knows is Master Way's arrival onto the scene. He can only imagine the happiness in Sir Way's face, but he doesn't see it for himself, as he finally makes his exit down the quiet back hallways until he is alone again in his room. He can still hear the faint noise of the band downstairs, but it's drowned out by the rattle of his lungs, the rough exhale of every breath. Frank is so relieved to finally make it to the familiar bookshop at the end of the street that he completely forgets about easing the door open so as not to ring the heavy, weighted bell that hangs above the frame. It tolls loudly, cutting through the respectful silence of the shop, and the other customers stop to look his way. The owner, Mr. Farnsworth, gives him a curt nod from behind the front counter, and Frank nods back, embarrassed. He hopes Mr. Farnsworth doesn't notice the freezing mud streaked all up and down his trouser legs. He's well known enough there that they won't kick him out for loitering, but he's in no place to pay for a book today. He'd been underdressed and unprepared for the storm that had broken over the town as he was walking back to his lodgings, and attempting to make it the 2 miles back in this weather was impossible. He knew better than to try. He pushes his soaking hair out of his face and makes his way down the aisle closer towards the inside of the store, where they usually keep a fire running in the large, squat office. There is a young couple in one of the aisles, and Frank has to angle his back to pass them by without dragging his wet coat along the spine of any of the books. When he arrives at the end of the aisle, and can feel the heat from the next room, finally, he makes sure to turn so his back bears the brunt of the warmth, especially his soaked collar and hair. He has a better view of the couple from the spot, and he picks up a book so as not to appear as if he is watching. It's hard not to look, though. They are young, he can tell, both dressed impeccably, and obviously infatuated. The girl is slight and pretty, with a pale oval face and light freckles on her nose. She's holding a book and fawning over the illustrations. Frank can see from the distance that it's a first edition, probably one of the Hartsteads that just arrived, and his heart pangs a little with the jealousy. He cannot imagine the price. The man is tall and lean, with dark, sharp features and a waxed mustache, standing slightly behind her and to the side. His hand barely hovers over her waist, not touching, but like a nervous bird afraid to land. Frank tries to hide the smile at the corner of his mouth that he knows is showing. About to be engaged, then, if they aren't already wed. He gets absorbed in the Shelley he's picked up. It's fascinating, but unfortunately a new edition, so he'll have to wait until it has been moved to one of the other shelves and passed over a few times, and completely tunes out the rest of the sounds of the store. He can almost begin to feel the warmth start seeping back into his bones. At some point, however, he glances up and finds the gentleman staring at him. Really staring at him. Frank's face flushes immediately, and he almost fumbles with his book, narrowly avoiding losing his grip completely. He's not used to anyone looking at him, not really, and the gentleman had been looking at him like... Frank doesn't know, but suddenly he's too warm, and uncomfortably so.
"Rupert, dearest," the girl coos, "have you even been listening?"
"Of course," the man says, voice light. "Every word."
She sighs with genuine affection, and cradles the book to her chest as she pulls the man away and down the aisle towards the front of the store. Frank stares at the floorboards until he can see out the corner of his eye that they've moved enough for him to slip by, undetected. He does so, not even caring that the bell rings loudly after him, not even caring that the cold, wet air immediately drains any of the warmth he had stored. It's not until he is almost half a mile down the road that he realizes that he is still clutching the book in his hands, fingers wrapped tight around the covers, the whole thing soaked. He pauses, momentarily torn with the decision, but continues on apace.
"But why can't we play Battle of Hastings again?" Matilda asks, dangling her feet off the side of the chaise. "This part is so dull."
"Because we've already covered the battle," Frank says, trying hard not to let his impatience show. "And sometimes history is full of dull bits." Matilda sighs and rests her head on her hands. Both of the children look slightly bored and tired, especially coupled with the excitement and late hour of the night before. But the idea of orchestrating a battle is just too much for Frank to contemplate at the moment, especially when all of his limbs feel like they are made of lead.
"Are you all right, sir?" James asks, quietly, as an aside. "Is the fire too warm?"
Frank's body is freezing, but his face must be flushed. It's becoming more noticeable, apparently, and if James can pick up on it, still more astute to subtle things in his sister, but not traditionally the most observant, Frank is not doing a very good job of hiding it. He steels himself and takes a deep breath. Not deep enough to rattle the coughs he knows are waiting, but enough.
"Have either of you ever read one of William Shakespeare's plays?" he asks, picking up another book from the table in front of him.
One of the other tutors tried, but they just have so many words,
Matilda groans.
But also sword fights,
Frank says, flipping to the table of contents and running his finger down the paper until he comes across the number.
And love in disguise, and magic, and plenty of parties.
I don't remember any parties,
Matilda says, disbelieving.
Or sword fights, James adds, sitting up straight. Are there really sword fights? I thought it was mostly lots of people saying boring poetry.
Well, there is some poetry, Frank says, but there are also plenty of parts where people fight and say poetry. Also, some truly spectacular death scenes.
You are the best tutor ever,
Matilda says, and Frank smiles down at his book.
Don't bite your thumb at me! I bit mine first! That's unfair!
James cries, gesturing at his sister. Rolf barks, running around his legs, excited by the proceedings.
A plague on your house, and yours, and yours,
Matilda says gleefully.
Plagues everywhere!
That's not technically your line, but we'll allow it this time,
Frank says.
Now, Matilda Montague, are you ready to fight against James Capulet?
Why are we fighting again?
Matilda asks, pausing to push the loose hair from her braids back off of her face, other hand loosely grasping the book of the script.
Because, Frank says, people do very silly things and fight about very silly things that they can't even remember. And because he's a Capulet.
Probably because you stole the Capulet's custard cup at the party last night,
James says.
You said I could have it,
Matilda says, stomping her feet a little.
Montagues, Capulets, pay attention, Frank says, raising his hand to catch their eyes. Matilda, you will be Mercutio. James, you will be Tybalt. Now,
who is going to be Romeo? Someone asks behind him, and Frank is so startled he actually drops the book in his hand. He ducks quickly to pick it up and turns, book cradled against his chest. Master Wei is standing in the doorway, smiling wide.
Uncle!
Matilda cries and runs over to him.
We're playing Shakespeare!
So I see. It seems Mr. Iero is instilling a true appreciation for poetry in you yet,
Master Wei says. Frank can't tell if he's joking or teasing or... But Mr. Iero, oh God, he must have talked to Sir Wei, and now he knows who Frank is, knows that he's just the tutor, and now he will never forgive him for being so rude to him in the cupboard at the party the night before.
And sword fights,
James says from next to Frank. Those always were the best parts, Master Wei says lightly.
May I join you? Oh, Master Wei, you don't...
Frank starts, immediately embarrassed by the whole situation. The Weis have always left him alone to teach as he saw fit, and he is suddenly incredibly worried that his methods will seem... simple. Peasant. Is Master Wei there to spy, to report back on what he sees? Are they worried about his abilities? His head feels faint, the room starting to swim.
You must, Matilda says, tugging on Master Wei's hand. You can be Romeo.
Only if Mr. Iero agrees not to call me Master Wei again, he says, watching Frank's face. It's so formal I do believe I will forget who I am. Gerard will be fine, unless Romeo is my part. Frank becomes aware that he probably looks horrified, face red.
Oh, yes, of course,
he says, covering as quickly as he can and reopening the book in his hands to the slightly dented page.
We've just started. Still in Act One.
Excellent, Gerard says warmly, and Frank looks back down at his book. Are you Juliet? He asks Matilda.
I'm Mercutio, she says proudly. I die soon. It's incredibly dramatic.
So I've heard, Gerard says, amused. Well, all right then. Let's get to the good part.
Gerard, as Frank comes to learn, is quite a natural performer. He knows many of the lines by heart, and captivates Matilda and James with his dramatic gestures and proclamations as he strides about the room. Matilda had quickly claimed the part of Juliet. Frank had been terrified for a moment that she would declare him to play the part, and he really did not need another reason for his face to redden, and took to it with aplomb, especially when Gerard lifted her onto the table to play the balcony scene. Frank is relegated to the director of the scene, which suits him just as well, off to the side, and making sure Matilda does not gesture so grandly she falls off the edge of the table. He cannot remember the last time he enjoyed a lesson so thoroughly, and finds himself actually laughing along at Gerard's overly dramatic acting. He looks up from the book at one moment, about to set the next scene, and finds Gerard watching him with a light, happy smile on his face. His eyes are warm, and Frank's hands still around the pages of the book, a finger light on the next line.
They get all the way to the secret wedding when the bell rings to call them to dinner, and the children actually groan in disappointment.
"We'll finish it up soon," Frank promises, collecting the books that he had spread out on the table.
"But I want to know what happens,"
Matilda says, leaning against the table.
"Terrible things," Gerard says, "and more poetry."
"Wonderful,"
Matilda says happily, and takes James's hand to lead him out of the study. Gerard stays behind, however, hand on the doorframe. Frank becomes acutely aware of the fact that they are alone together, and his mind flashes back to the night before at the party.
"I'm so sorry about the cupboard," Frank manages, neatly lining up the edges of some of his papers.
"For what?" Gerard asks, sounding completely baffled.
"Last night at the party, in the cupboard, for my rudeness and lack of propriety. I was surprised and apparently forgot all my manners, and—" Frank begins, but Gerard simply shrugs and waves a hand. "I wouldn't expect anyone to be prepared for strange men hiding in cupboards," Gerard says. "I should be apologizing to you."
I should have introduced myself properly," Frank says, lifting the stack of books into his arms. "I didn't mean to lead you to think I was—"
"You didn't lead me to think anything," Gerard says. "You were quite polite, even after I admitted to talking to sacks of flour, and did not, in fact, tell anyone I was in the cupboard. The only slight I can find is that I did not see you again at the party."
Frank is startled that he remembered the suggestion.
"Oh, no, I'm afraid not. I retired early."
"Well, in that case, you can make it up to me by joining the family for dinner," Gerard says, tapping two of his fingers against the frame.
"I can't," Frank replies immediately.
Gerard raises his eyebrows, obviously surprised at the denial.
"Well, I can," Frank begins again. I usually take dinner up in my room. I'm not properly dressed. You really don't have to."
"I don't," Gerard says, smiling. "And you don't, if you don't actually want to. But my brother speaks highly of you, as does Alicia, and the children love you. It would be quite nice to speak over food that was not a half-empty tin of biscuits in the servants' pantry." Frank hesitates, and then sets the stack of books back down on the table. He's tempted to decline. It would be proper, and surely Gerard exaggerates out of obligation. But he thinks of the simple meal and plain toast he would normally take up in his quiet room, and suddenly it doesn't seem appealing at all.
"That would be quite nice, thank you," Frank says, and Gerard grins.
The meal is entirely different than anything Frank has ever experienced before. His family meals were usually his mother and him sitting at their small wooden table by the fire, his mother's cold hands holding his while she recited grace. There are still several relatives in town for Sir Way's birthday party, and the entire dining room is lively and full, lit bright with candlelight and the newly polished silverware. Frank nervously tugs at the hem of his coat as he follows Gerard into the room, slightly terrified they will send him away.
"Frank!" Sir Way calls out happily. "So glad you could join us. It's largely remains from the party last night, as most of the kitchen staff has the day off, but I hope you won't mind the repeat."
"Oh, no, not at all,"
Frank says, bowing his head slightly. He's never actually dined with them before, and darts his eyes around the table, looking for somewhere to sit. "Here, Frank," Gerard says, gesturing to the empty seat beside him. Every other seat at the table is taken, and Frank cannot help but wonder if Gerard had mentioned to them, even before he arrived at the lesson that morning, that he would be extending Frank an invitation. Frank remains quiet through most of the meal. He's overwhelmed by the laughter, the ease with which the family converses as they eat, so obviously happy to be in one another's company. The ill feeling that had been plaguing Frank for the majority of the day is momentarily relieved, even though his appetite remains thin, and he can barely manage to push the food lightly around on his plate. The next day at lessons, Gerard arrives again, just when the children's minds are set to wander. He isn't there the next day, but on Thursday he knocks at the door again, midway through the morning geography plan. He spins the ancient globe on his knee, and points out all of the countries he's visited, and many of the tamed down, Frank is certain, stories of his times in each. Matilda and James are fascinated. Frank is selfishly glad for it. He wishes he could blame it all on Gerard's ability to convince Matilda and James that just about any learning experience is an exciting one, giving Frank a modicum of a rest when it seems like he tires earlier and earlier as the days progress.
Gerard smiles so freely, though, seems so at ease, Frank can't help but watch him, as if it is a quality he himself could learn. Gerard is a foreboding Prospero, a manic Puck, and a truly moving Frankenstein. One of Frank's favorite stories, although he doesn't voice it aloud. Gerard helps Frank when he needs it, a few times when he doesn't, and sometimes he simply slips in the room in the middle of a lesson, greets the children, and props himself in the corner with a sketchbook and a pencil, gently scritching away as Frank helps the children pick out Polaris on a star map. Frank is walking down the art gallery late one night, long after the candles in the main hall have been put out, on his way to the kitchen to hopefully make some tea to soothe his throat, when he is completely startled by the figure of a man in shadows at the other end of the gallery. Frank immediately takes a step back, hiding behind the heavy wood of the doorframe. It's Gerard, still dressed, although his waistcoat appears unbuttoned, standing on one of the long, low benches that are scattered around the walls of the gallery, where the frames of the paintings don't hang too low. Gerard looks strange, far off and undisturbed, and the gallery is so dark Frank can only make out the pale of his skin outside the jet of black cloth that makes up his clothes. He's facing a painting. Frank can't see, but he knows by memory that it's a family portrait, back when Gerard and Sir Way were barely into their teens, just before his parents passed away, and a few years before the death of their grandmother, if Frank remembers correctly. He feels suddenly horribly intrusive. This is obviously a private moment, and Frank is spying, but he can't seem to pull himself away. Gerard isn't smiling, or leaning against the doorframe of Frank's study, or making any dramatic gestures. He looks so young in the dim light, and unmoving, it's almost like looking directly at one of the portraits. Gerard raises a hand and gently touches something on the painting in front of him. A face, a hand, the feeling of the oils. Frank can't be sure, but it is a tender gesture, and he hears Gerard sigh, so low, so resigned, that Frank's heart aches. There's a tickle in the back of Frank's throat, and he knows a cough is on the way. He pulls himself back and darts down the side hall, giving the gallery as wide of a berth as possible. He drinks his tea in the quiet, dark kitchen as quickly as he can without scalding his mouth, and when he passes back to his room, he glances into the gallery. Gerard is gone, the only sign he was there in the first place, a palm-sized smear in the frosting on the glass by the portrait, where he'd obviously leaned over to look outside.
Iero, there's a message here for you, a courier from the service, the landlord says, hand still on the doorknob, his face grave. Frank's mouth immediately goes dry. It's a short letter, sparse, and Frank reads it quickly while the courier waits by the side of his desk, patiently holding the small wrapped parcel in his hands. His mother is dead, it tells him, in short, fat type. They have already arranged the funeral. She is buried next to his father, and the parcel is for him. The courier hands it to him, bows lightly, and then quietly disappears. Frank wonders, almost in a haze, how many messages he's had to deliver today, if they all were like Frank's. He has to sit. His knees won't support him, like all the marrow has been sucked out of his bones. And the string holding the package closed is wet and knotted, almost impossible to undo. He ends up having to slash it with his dinner knife. There's no letter inside, no note. His mother's necklace, a plain gold locket his father gave to her for their wedding. The portraits inside, too faded and damp to ever be able to recognize a face. Some legal documents from their lawyer. Her tiny, worn book of prayers, with the ribbon she embroidered herself, Hallowed Be Thy Name, in her meticulous, faded red stitches down the middle. And, at the bottom, a small envelope, not even sealed, with a few crumpled banknotes inside. There is nothing else. Frank holds the necklace so tightly in his fist he's surprised it doesn't crack. But when he realizes and opens his palm, there's a deep, red heart pressed into the skin. He stands up, pulls on his coat, and goes down the street to the pub.
The orchard on the south side of the manor is long, squat, and sprawling. It would produce more in season if the family took more diligent care with it. But Lady Wei has always remarked on how fond she was that it was a little bit wild, and the gardeners have kept it healthy and in some semblance of order, but only just enough to let it do what it wished. Several trees gnarl together at the top, blocking out the light in patches, and the ground is a maze of knotted tree roots and slightly swollen, bruised fruit. It is one of Frank's favorite places on the entire estate. He is sitting on the low, white stone wall along the east side with a book on his lap as Matilda and James run about under the trees. He'd been working all morning with them on numbers and figures, but the monotony had proved too much for their dispositions, and he'd relented in taking them outdoors for a bit. Even he was the slightest bit relieved. Numbers were never quite as exciting as sword fights, and even he could agree to that. The clouds rolling in over the woods in the distance are sleek, and a cool, foreboding gray, but Frank can't help but enjoy the moment. There's a storm coming in by the evening, with a sharp breeze rolling the dead leaves about his feet, but it feels nice, and mimics the children as they chase each other through the trees.
"I was starting to think you only existed in that study, like some little spirit," a voice says behind him, and Frank turns to see Gerard approaching from the direction of the house, hands deep in the pockets of his thick coat. He's smiling warmly, collar turned up against the wind, and his hair is messily whipped about his face even more than usual.
"Do you usually see spirits in the daylight hours?" Frank asks, pushing his own loose hair back off of his face. "I thought they usually took to wandering halls at night, with chains and things."
He thinks of Gerard, briefly, hand outstretched towards the painting on the wall, but out in the light of day it seems like a passage from a book he once read, rather than anything real. Gerard sits down next to him on the wall, hands still deep in his pockets.
"A different kind of spirit, perhaps," he says. "Maybe one that lives in the little spaces between books, or the lines on a page."
Frank holds his tongue as he looks out into the orchard as Matilda's dark curls dart between the gaps in the trees.
"I'm afraid to admit that I am quite the opposite of supernatural, quite real, and stuck to the earth. It must come as such a disappointment."
"Not in the least," Gerard says, and Frank ignores the way his stomach flips.
"Well, if you are going to ruin my exciting theory, the least you can do is tell me where you did come from before this, if not the pages of the library," he asks.
He seems so genuinely interested, like the stories of Frank's history could ever in some way rival his own.
Hours later, Frank is so drunk he can barely walk, has to keep his feet planted firmly on the low brass rung around the bottom of the dark wooden bar. There are a couple of men in the corner playing music, something bright and lively, but Frank tunes them out to just watch the piano player's thin, quick hands. He sips again at his gin, letting it burn in his mouth before he swallows it down. The necklace is still in his palm, dead metal against his skin, but he keeps his fist tight. He feels disgusting and queasy, and he doesn't want any more, doesn't, can't, but he's paid for it with the money from the parcel, and he can't let it go to waste. He looks up again. Time has passed, he cannot tell how long, and suddenly the gentleman from the bookstore is at the other side of the bar, turned towards the musicians. He sees Frank, or he's been watching him forever, it feels like, and gives Frank the slightest nod and a small, practiced motion of the wrist. His gloves are clean, the edges of his shirt pressed and cuffed closed. He doesn't belong there, but acts like he does. Something pools in Frank's belly, hot and dark and writhing, and he knows it's not the gin. It looks like the man is going to come over to him, maybe speak, but Frank can't bear it, doesn't know what he'll do. He slides off the stool and shoves several more banknotes from the envelope across the bar before he slips out the back door and stumbles into the street. The next morning he awakens with the worst headache he has ever had in his life. He can't even open his eyes. He is still in his clothes from the night before, sans coat, and the buttons on his waistcoat are half-buttoned, almost entirely incorrectly. Frank almost doesn't mind the headache, as it means there isn't any room for anything else in his mind, not damp parcels or unsealed envelopes or his mother, sitting by the fire, always stitching. The next morning he wakes, cleans himself, shaves, and goes down to the post office to put in a notice to the paper. He spends the next 3 weeks holed up in his room, reading, rereading, and tending to his books. Knowledge,
his mother always said, would be the only thing that would ever truly save him, make him better than himself. He doesn't know how much stock he puts into the idea, but it is a distraction and helps him to ignore how foolish he was to think someone would see his advertisement and care. On the third week, however, there's a courier again, a different one, and Frank is selfishly glad, at his door, with another note. This one, however, is handwritten, in a loose, casual hand, and the tone is warm. There's no necklace, just an offer, and 2 days later, Frank packs up the rest of his books into his small suitcase. He spends the last note from the envelope in renting a carriage to take him towards the address listed at the bottom of the letter. The "Sincerely Yours" had been underlined twice. He's never traveled out of the county before, but he honestly cannot care, especially when there is the hope, foolish that it may be, that somewhere exists where people expect him to arrive, and sincerely so.
"Just on the other side of Dalton, actually," Frank says. "The very far other side, where a family like the Ways would undoubtedly pass around, shades on their carriage doors pulled firmly down. Not that he could ever blame them, really, as he always wished to do the same. Mikey mentioned you haven't gone home yet. Even mentioned it, even with the upcoming holiday," Gerard says. And it takes Frank a moment to realize even what he has said. He is so caught up in reconciling the largely stoic Sir Way with the Mikey of Gerard's warm affection. Eventually, however, he is pulled back to the present, and his entire body stills. "Doesn't your family miss you all the way up here? I'm sure you could invite them up for a spell. There's plenty of room for guests," Gerard continues.
"That's quite all right," Frank says, far more stiffly than he actually feels, but Gerard's face falls immediately.
"Oh, Frank," he says, with such familiarity in his voice that Frank is almost lightheaded with it. "I'm so sorry. I'm always doing that, saying things I shouldn't. Mikey will never forgive me for being such a fool. I apologize. I'm terrible about prying."
"No, it's all right," Frank repeats, leaning back to a more comfortable position on the wall. "It is what it is, even if it's just me."
He hesitates, looking back down at the book in his hands.
"In spaces between books, or the lines on the page."
Gerard is quiet on the wall beside him. His boots are muddy, spattered with it all up the sides of his calves and trousers. It hasn't rained yet, which either means he's been out in the stables, or down by the creek on the other side of the property, probably sketching again, if the dark tips of his fingers are any indication. And when he swipes them across his face to push back his hair, they leave a dark smudge against the pale of his cheekbone. Gerard turns, then, and catches Frank's eye, pausing the motion. But Frank is saved having to duck his head in apology by a cry coming out from within the depths of the trees. He has to shift farther away from Gerard to see what is actually happening, and he is relieved by even the modicum of space between them again.
"James," he calls out, frowning, "don't throw things at your sister, or we'll have to go back inside early."
"You're quite good with them, you know," Gerard says.
"They talk about you all the time."
"Really now," Frank says, scoffing a little, settling more back into his place, still slightly farther from Gerard than he was before.
"I can't imagine there is much to say."
"I can," Gerard says, so simply, as if the notion that Frank is an interesting thing to discuss is fact. Although they are terrible about talking about the things I really want to know.
"Well, what about you?" Frank says, desperate to change the subject away from himself. "I've heard plenty of your stories about what happened to you on the continent. Why did you decide to go in the first place?"
"I would say studying art and literature, but it was largely an excuse for me to do foolish things from out of the view of our extended relatives," Gerard says lightly. "They love me, most certainly, but more often when I wasn't around making a mess of things."
Frank feels so completely unsteady about the whole conversation. He has to make sure both of his feet are planted firmly on the ground. He's strangely, irrationally angry that he never had any siblings to speak to. Gerard speaks so frankly, so honestly, it seems the only way was to have had an outlet in which to do so, separate than the way Frank writes things in a small, curved hand in his own private journals.
"May I ask you a question?" Frank asks, pausing,
hoping he is not about to step too far, even as Gerard's presence makes him forget about the rules that govern him, even for the moment.
Why is the manor Sir Way's and not yours, as the eldest?"
Gerard is quiet for a moment, and rubs the toe of his boot against an exposed root. Some of the mud dried on the leather flakes off.
I signed it over to him after our grandmother died. It seemed unfair to keep it when I was never going to be the one to fill it with a family.
Really?
Frank asks, completely surprised.
But you seem so good with the children.
Not in my future, I'm afraid. Mikey's always been better with the estate anyway, more tied to it than I was. I spent so much of my childhood wishing to be anywhere else but here, it would have been very cruel to keep it. It's much better this way, full of people, and family. Purpose.
Yes, Frank agrees,
thinking back to the warm, bright dining room, the night after the party for Sir Wei's birthday.
It's nice,
he finishes, rather lamely, embarrassed by the idea that Gerard might see how attached he is to the house when Frank is just a guest.
Uncle!
Matilda calls out from the trees, interrupting his thoughts as she runs quickly over to them.
I didn't know you were here! How long have you been here?
I just arrived, Gerard says, smiling. It's just about time for tea. Would you like to head back, or is there more to the lesson for today? He looks at Frank at the last part, and there's something about his mouth. Bemused, wry, something, that Frank can't figure out.
Let's go, Matilda says, and quickly, before James comes over. He threw a stick at me. We should leave him.
I'm afraid your mother would be very disappointed in me if we did, even for stick throwing, Gerard says, and takes her little hand in his. James runs up past Frank to lope along beside Gerard as they head back over the little hill towards the front of the house. Gerard pauses, only once, to look over his shoulder and make sure Frank is close behind. But Matilda pulls on his hand to point out a little sparrow hanging upside down to the branch of the oak, and he turns away again.